after his death. Al Jazeera read part of his message on air.
If these words reach you, know that Israel has succeeded in killing me and silencing my voice. I have lived through pain in all its details, tasted suffering and loss many times. Yet I never once hesitated to convey the truth as it is, without distortion or falsification, so that God may bear witness against those who stayed silent and accepted our killing. He ends, "Do not forget Gaza, and do not forget me in your sincere prayers for forgiveness and acceptance."
The words of Anas al-Sharif, posted after he was killed by the Israeli military, along with five other journalists. Five of them were with Al Jazeera. Irene Khan, I want to thank you so much for being with us, UN Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Opinion and Expression, speaking to us from Geneva, Switzerland. To see our interview with the managing editor of Al Jazeera, go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Nicole Salazar, Sarah Nasser, Charina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Ravi Karan, Hani Masood, Safwat Nazal. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The nominating committee meets on the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Our KBOO Out Loud Fall Membership Drive is coming. Tune in August 20th, where we'll bring you testimonials, anecdotes, facts, and more, all day long to celebrate National Radio Day. KBOO, made by people like you, for people like you.
Support for KBOO comes from our members and from the Neocony Coast Art and Music Cultural Foundation, presenting Rockaway Beach Music Festival, an all-ages music and arts festival in Rockaway Beach on August 16th and 17th. The event will feature live music, local food, art exhibits, and local craft vendors. More info at rbmusicfest.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a new report from Tina Kotek's office outlines some of the so-called Big Beautiful Bill's harsh effects on Oregon. New technology is monitoring the Columbia River Basin's temperatures. And in national news, Trump has commandeered the D.C. police. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, August 12th, 2025. I'm Eric Leuschner. Oregon stands to lose a great deal to the recently passed Big Beautiful Bill. According to a report from Governor Tina Kotek's office released Monday, Oregon could lose more than $15 billion in federal funding for food aid, health care, and other services. Almost $3 billion will be lost from the SNAP program over the next 6 years. Over $11.5 billion from Medicare lost in that time. $13 million from state libraries and about $5 million from state parks, and it goes on. Medicaid expects that there will be significant increases in staffing costs to pay for people to receive the increase in applications that are required to qualify for Medicaid and SNAP. They expect there will be additional pressures on the food bank system as SNAP benefits decrease availability. If Oregon brings the error rate from SNAP below 5.99%, the state will avoid the penalty of being responsible for 15% on SNAP costs annually. The report notes that, as a result of these things, more Oregonians will experience hunger and reduced access to nutritious foods. Medicaid expects many people who do not have citizen status will move to the Healthier Oregon program in 2026 when they lose their access to Medicaid due to $22 million in funding cuts to serving this population. The governor said, quote, "The Trump administration and Republicans in Congress have betrayed American children and families who will become sicker, hungrier, and less prosperous because of President Trump's budget bill. Oregonians will see less of their federal tax dollars coming back to our state for the things they count on," end quote. Making matters worse, tax cuts within the bill will diminish Oregon's state revenues by nearly $1 billion during the current budget. That's because the state uses federal taxable income as the starting point when calculating what residents owe in state taxes. Urban and community forestry assistance programs will lose half its funding in the 2025-2027 biennium. The department will have to cut jobs and programs. Similarly, the library system will have to think about cutting jobs long-term and will not be able to offer grants to the community. A new tool is tracking warming waters in the Columbia River Basin. Isabel Charlet has more on the story.
A University of Washington team has developed a groundbreaking method to get river temperature data for the Columbia River Basin from NASA satellites. Their open source tool is called Thermal History of Regulated Rivers, or THOR, and offers 40 plus years of historical and current temperature data for rivers in Washington, Oregon, and Idaho. Charles Seaton is with the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission, who helped develop the tool. He says they plan to use it to support salmon populations, among other things.
To be able to say, we'd like to know what was happening everywhere in the system for the last 40 years in terms of temperature, and be able to say, here's that data at all of these different places throughout the system is just a really amazing tool.
He says the data will have many uses to support salmon, including knowing where to release more water from dams to cool the river down. He also hopes to see how development of data centers along the river has affected water temperature over time. University of Washington PhD student George Darqua started THOR using NASA satellite data dating back to the 1980s. He says it was important to make the data accessible to everyone because there are so many potential uses for it across different fields.
They know how best they can use it. Scientists can access it, engineers can access it, and then people that we do not even think about can also have access to it.
Now that the tool works in the Northwest, Darqua hopes to expand its reach globally so people can get water temperature data for remote rivers that would otherwise be inaccessible.
And I feel this approach to studying river temperatures makes it very easy. It means we can scale up to the global level, and that's a very important thing. It's not limited at all.
He adds THOR can still provide temperature readings even on cloudy days by modeling historical weather conditions. For Public News Service, I'm Isabel Charlet.
On Monday, President Donald Trump took federal control of the Washington, D.C. police, deploying federal agents and 800 National Guard troops. He described this move as necessary to protect the nation's capital from, quote, bloodthirsty criminals, end quote, who he claims have overrun the city. This decision follows the Trump administration's attempt to reshape the narrative surrounding events in the capital city. Earlier this year, President Trump pardoned violent criminals involved in the January 6th attack, many of whom were already serving sentences for their actions. At a 78-minute news conference, the president, flanked by several cabinet members, presented papers and statistics comparing Washington, D.C. to other global cities. However, he overlooked one critical fact. Violent crime has recently fallen in the U.S. Capitol. Although it surged during the pandemic and peaked in 2023. It dropped by 35% in 2024 compared to the previous year, according to the Metropolitan Police Department. Data shows that from January 1st to August 10th, each year since 2010, violent crimes have decreased. In 2023, when violent crimes reached a high of 3,300, the number has now fallen to 1,600 reported incidents in 2025. In typical fashion, the president spreads notions of fear and chaos using rhetoric similar to that employed at the southern border to rally support from his base. He painted D.C. as an urban hellscape, asserting that, quote, caravans of mass youth, end quote, are rampant in the city, and he shared stories of children caught in shootings, blaming Democrat-run cities for the rise in crime. President Trump further criticized the city, saying, quote, our capital city has been overtaken by violent gangs and bloodthirsty criminals, roving mobs of wild youth, drugged-out maniacs, and homeless people, and we're not going to let it happen anymore, end quote. Local officials responded immediately, criticizing the president's actions as a small group of protesters emerged throughout the D.C. area after the administration declared a public safety emergency. D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser called Trump's actions, quote, unsettling and unprecedented, end quote, but noted she wasn't surprised. The Democratic mayor emphasized, quote, there's nobody here and certainly nobody who works for me who wants to tolerate any level of crime. We work every day to stop crime, end quote. President Trump plans to rely on a 1973 congressional provision of the D.C. Home Rule Act, which allows the president to temporarily take control of the D.C. Metro Police Department. A White House official indicated that this takeover would last the full 30 days allowed by law. During his address, the president did not shy away from targeting other Democratic-run cities, saying they could face similar actions if they did not get their crime under control, saying, quote, I'm going to look at New York in a little while, and if we need to, we're going to do the same thing in Chicago, which is a disaster, end quote. President Trump places D.C. police under federal control. With that story and more, it's Catherine Carley with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
This is Liberation Day in D.C., and we're going to take our capital back. We're taking it back.
President Donald Trump is taking control of the Washington, D.C. police and deploying the National Guard, he says, to make the capital safe. Trump says other cities, including Baltimore, Chicago, and New York, could be next. The president cites individual incidents like an attempted carjacking of a former DOGE employee, but violent crime in the district is actually at a 30-year low. Hundreds of local residents and elected officials are denouncing the move, saying it underscores the need for D.C. statehood. Samantha Davis is with the group Free D.C.
This is not about crime. This is about control. This is not about public safety. This is about power.
Trump says homeless people must, quote, immediately move far from the Capitol, although it's unclear where they would go. The Texas standoff over new congressional districts has entered its second week with no end in sight. The legislature remains stalled while more than 50 Democrats remain out of state, keeping it from reaching a quorum. Republican Governor Greg Abbott says he can wait.
I'm authorized to call a special session every 30 days. It lasts 30 days. And as soon as this one is over, I'm going to call another one, then another one, then another one, then another one.
Abbott says Democrats who return to the state will be arrested and taken to the Capitol. California may redistrict in response, but Governor Gavin Newsom says they would drop their plans if Texas does too. The Supreme Court will decide this fall whether to take up a case challenging the legality of same-sex marriage. A Kentucky county clerk who spent 6 days in jail in 2015 for refusing to issue same-sex marriage licenses has petitioned the court. She cited Justice Clarence Thomas's opinion that the court should revisit the decision. Partisan use of scientific data may be driving Democrats and Republicans further apart. A new study finds Democrats cite scientific research nearly twice as often in Congress and five times as often in think tank reports. Alexander Furnas with Northwestern University says Republicans express far less trust in science.
We observe these partisan differences both in their attitudes towards science and in the kind of documents that these folks actually produce that have policy impacts.
Furnas says the research is concerning for those who believe science should establish facts, while politics can determine what to do about them. The Congressional Budget Office estimates 10 million Americans will lose their health insurance under the Republican mega bill passed last month. It estimates that overall, the law will cost low-income households about $1,200 a year, while wealthier households benefit by more than $13,000. And Harvard University and the Trump administration are reportedly near to a legal settlement that would restore billions of dollars in federal research grants. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News in Depth. At 6 o'clock, it's This Way Out. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be hot. Today we have a high of 98 degrees and a low of 65. And tomorrow will be cooler with a high of 83 and a low of 61. Today in history, in 1990, the most complete skeleton of a Tyrannosaurus rex ever found was discovered by Susan Hendrickson near Faith, South Dakota. The quote of the day is from Colin Mochrie, Canadian and Scottish actor. He said, quote, "We all have a dinosaur deep within us just trying to get out." Colville tribal officials are hailing the discovery of a Chinook salmon in British Columbia's Kettle River as another sign of success of their salmon reintroduction program. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Colville tribal officials are hailing the discovery of a Chinook salmon in British Columbia's Kettle River as another sign of success of their salmon reintroduction program. Spokane Public Radio's Steve Jackson reports.
It's been decades since a Chinook was last seen upstream from Cooley Dam in the Kettle River in British Columbia.
It's significant because, you know, Grand Coulee Dam cut off salmon from going to the ocean and back in 1941. So for over 80 years, salmon haven't been in the Kettle River.
That's Casey Baldwin, a salmon reintroduction manager for the Colville Tribes. He says the program has released more than 160,000 juvenile fish per year since 2017, including about 25,000 at Kettle Falls. Some of those fish have been tracked making their way down the Columbia River system to the ocean, and many have managed to survive passing through the Grand Coulee Dam turbines. While this Chinook salmon was not examined specifically by fish biologists, Baldwin says it's very likely the result of the release program. Baldwin says his agency is also currently tracking one wild adult fish with a special ID tag that's returning up the Columbia from the sea. If the fish can make it as far as Chief Joseph Dam, the hope is that it can be captured and trucked upstream to a tributary above Grand Coulee. For National Native News, I'm Steve Jackson reporting from Spokane.
In recent months, the Institute of American Indian Arts, or IAIA, in Santa Fe, New Mexico, was one of many tribal colleges facing federal funding cuts. KUNM's Jeanette Didio spoke with IAIA's new president, Shelley Lowe, to get an update on where the prominent Indigenous art school stands.
President Trump's budget proposal threatens to reduce the school's federal allocation from around $13 million to zero beginning October 1st. Lowe says there have been threats to federal funding all across the country, but she's thankful that she continues to see support from the school's appropriators and Congress.
They are on board to support us. You know, we're still out there trying to make sure that their constituencies, our own constituencies, know very well what we are doing and the importance of it.
Lowe says she's planning for a normal fall semester and has no intention of changing anything.
We're going to keep talking to our appropriators and ensuring that we have enough funding. And we're going to be out there really looking for donors and looking for individuals who are interested in supporting the institution. But we're moving forward as normal for the next year, and we'll just keep working hard.
According to the Santa Fe New Mexican, the Interior Department's appropriation bill passed both the Senate and House Appropriations Committee, which includes a $12 million appropriation for IAIA. The bill now advances to the full House and Senate for consideration. For National Native News, I'm Jeanette Didios.
the Medicine Wheel Ride, an Indigenous-led fundraiser during the Sturgis Motorcycle Rally in South Dakota, recently completed its sixth year. This year, an estimated 230 rode from Bear Butte State Park across the Black Hills to raise awareness for missing and murdered Indigenous people. The setting of Sturgis is particularly pertinent as Native Hope, a South Dakota nonprofit, considers the rally a major driver of human trafficking. This year's ride was sponsored by Harley-Davidson, and registered riders paid an entry fee dedicated to MMIP justice efforts. U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski, chair of the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs, will host a roundtable Thursday in Anchorage, Alaska, on a draft legislative package addressing recommendations from a Native Children Commission, which was issued last year. According to Murkowski's office, discussions are aimed at advancing the well-being and future opportunities for Native children. The event is open to the public and will be live-streamed. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Goodwill's Clean Tech Accelerator trains people for clean energy jobs. The program offers paid training in solar installation, EV charger maintenance, heat pump installation, and more. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. When people buy used goods and vintage clothes from Goodwill, that money helps fund job training programs, including a new effort to prepare people for careers in clean energy. Goodwill's Clean Tech Accelerator launched in 5 states last year and is now expanding to more. It offers paid training in solar installation, electric vehicle charger maintenance, and more.
Most people that come to us are coming to us because they're looking for a new opportunity. They have either been stuck in one particular industry or job and they're wanting to gain a new skill, and then they're wanting to provide a better life for themselves and their family.
Monique McDaniels is with Goodwill in South Carolina. Her chapter is training people to install and service HVAC systems and electric heat pumps, which can heat and cool a home without oil or gas. Participants get hands-on experience with the technology.
We'll have an actual lab where they'll be working on the actual machines. They'll be able to touch it, feel it, break it apart.
She says market research shows there are already well-paid jobs in her area for people with these skills.
You can come in with very little knowledge or experience. You can gain these skills and really create the quality of life that you're looking for yourselves and for your family.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
On Monday, August 12th, a federal judge rejected the Trump administration's request to release the grand jury testimony of Ghislaine Maxwell, a longtime confidant of Jeffrey Epstein and convicted sex offender. U.S. District Judge Paul Engelmeyer made it clear that there were no special circumstances justifying the public release of these documents. This ruling follows the administration's request last month, which cited, quote, abundant public interest, end quote. The request was part of the administration's efforts to address the controversy surrounding the mishandling of the release of the Jeffrey Epstein files after pledging full transparency on the matter. However, Judge Engelmeyer added more fuel to the public interest in the Epstein files by saying, quote, its entire premise that the Maxwell grand jury materials would bring to light meaningful new information about Epstein's and Maxwell's crimes or the government's investigation into them is demonstrably false, end quote. In his rebuke, Judge Engelmeyer noted that there was no new insight into Epstein or Maxwell, no new sources regarding their wealth, information about the venue, or any new circumstances surrounding Epstein's death. He concluded by stating, quote, there is no there, end quote. This decision follows a series of requests by the administration to 3 other federal judges before the case landed on Judge Engelmeyer's bench. The 3 federal judges came from 2 in Manhattan and 1 in Florida. All were asked to unseal the grand jury transcripts related to Epstein and Maxwell. The lone judge in Florida, Federal Judge Robin Rosenberg, denied the request, citing 11th Circuit law doesn't allow for the release of such records, end quote. With this latest court loss, the Trump administration is left with limited options, having failed to meet the high threshold required to unseal these federal documents. Ghislaine Maxwell is currently serving a 20-year prison sentence for charges related to facilitating Epstein's abuse of girls. In 1955, Teamsters organizer William Grammy was kidnapped for organizing 350 workers. Rick Smith has more with Labor History in 2.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1955. That was the day Teamsters organizer, 28-year-old William Grammy, was kidnapped and beaten. Grammy had arrived in Sebastopol, California, to help organize about 350 workers in local canneries, drying plants, and fruit sheds. The Teamsters had been on campaign footing for months in an attempt to win union recognition, higher wages, better working conditions, and benefits. They had lost a union representation election the previous fall after Sebastopol apple growers moved quickly to lay off union supporters. By January, cannery workers at Oscar Hall & Sons voted for union representation. The workers at Barlow Company would vote against the union just 2 months later. But by early August, the strike wave hit. Workers walked off the job at the Sebastopol Cooperative Cannery. More at seven other area canneries joined them on strike in the days that followed. Grammy would later testify that he had heard reports weeks earlier of a grower threatening to have him killed within 3 hours should any strike actually take place. During the strike that would ultimately prove victorious, three men kidnapped Grammy outside the union's hall. He was driven along a rural road, tied to a pole, gagged, and beaten with a bicycle chain. Left for dead, he was found the next day and hospitalized immediately. But the union and the strikers remained undeterred. Before the strike was over, scab trucks attempting to haul apples to market were vandalized and burned, and scab drivers were beaten. 8 months later, the apple industry finally came to the negotiating table. By May of 1956, apple growers signed with the Teamsters.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.
President Trump has long harbored the notion of deploying U.S. forces to attack the drug cartels in Mexico. The legal and other obstacles to doing so, including Mexico's strong opposition, seem to escape him. Is this another deliberate distraction from the Epstein case and an economic downturn? Now we go to Global Citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. Donald Trump is proving time and again to foreign leaders that counting on friendly relations is senseless. Most recently, India, Canada, Ukraine, and Brazil discovered that, contrary to expectations, Trump is not influenced by historical ties or long-term common interests. He will treat them like adversaries if there is immediate advantage to doing so. Now Mexico joins the list. Trump has long had the idea of pursuing drug dealers into Mexico. The New York Times reports that he has signed a secret directive to the Pentagon that could lead to the dispatch of U.S. air and ground forces into Mexico or other countries on the pretext of fighting terrorism, a designation the State Department began using once Trump took office. To say the least, Trump's order raises numerous legal, practical, and foreign policy questions, such as armed intervention in another country, the lack of congressional authorization or even consultation, the killing of civilians abroad, and the use of the armed forces instead of law enforcement agencies to fight drug trafficking. Most relevant is the opposition of the target country, Mexico in this case. Its president, Claudia Sheinbaum, is adamant on the subject. Quote, "The U.S. is not going to come to Mexico with the military. We cooperate, we collaborate, but there is not going to be an invasion. That is ruled out, absolutely ruled out," she said. "Nor is a U.S. invasion, quote, part of any agreement, far from it. When it has been brought up, we have always said no." In April, she rejected Trump's request to allow U.S. forces into Mexico to attack drug cartels. Clearly, Trump isn't taking no for an answer. The precedent of U.S. troops dispatched in 1989 to arrest Panama's leader, Manuel Noriega, on drug trafficking charges is instructive. The United Nations General Assembly condemned the invasion as a, quote, flagrant violation of international law. Yet the U.S. military has been involved in anti-drug operations for years, though usually in cooperation with Latin American governments, including Mexico's. Now, Secretary of State Marco Rubio is claiming the administration's right, quote, to use other elements of American power, intelligence agencies, the Department of Defense, whatever, to target these groups if we have an opportunity to do it, unquote. No suggestion here of a role for Congress or the need of the target country's consent. the administration might act unilaterally in the same way it assassinated Iran's military commander, Major General Qasem Soleimani, in a U.S. drone strike in January 2020. It is highly unlikely that the legal offices within the Pentagon will seek to restrain such unilateral actions. The offices of legal counsel and judge advocates have been so weakened under Trump that legal guidelines are likely to be ignored by Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, who insists on a more muscular armed services. The highly questionable designation of Mexican and Venezuelan gangs as terrorist groups is in keeping with a Latin America policy under Trump that portrays every undesirable situation as a threat to national security, thus justifying illegal U.S. actions. Those actions include the demand that Brazil abort its trial of coup leader Jair Bolsonaro or face 50% tariff rates, the deportations to El Salvador, the ongoing embargo against Cuba, and the $50 million bounty for the arrest of Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro. These latest threats of invasion reveal a purely negative and aggressive Latin America policy that will provoke angry receptions in much of the region, where fears of the Colossus of the North remain very much alive. Trump may be bluffing here. His pursuit of a Nobel Peace Prize might be worth more than bombing a drug cartel. But with his economic policies in deep trouble and the Epstein affair not going away, I think it's entirely possible that he will act impulsively in Mexico. The politics of distraction is already well underway, never mind that Mexico's cooperation on migration and the drug cartels has been effective. Until Trump's directive, its officials reportedly believed that relations with the U.S. were on the upswing. The U.S. ambassador to Mexico, Ronald Johnson, said in July that the greatly reduced drug flow and border crossings were, quote, due to a secure border and increased collaboration between the U.S. and Mexico, unquote. That collaboration will vanish with an invasion. If the U.S. does this without Mexico's consent, it will set the relationship back 100 years, said Todd Robinson, who was the Assistant Secretary of State for International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs in the Biden administration. Mexicans should know better than to count on a U.S. president who is oblivious to facts and has no problem reversing policy on a dime. I'm Mel Gertoff for the Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.